he's missing a lot of opportunities, and the wavering obviously has some donor types wondering, is he really serious about this? But I think what is clear is there isn't really a clear lane for him as long as Nikki Haley and Mike Pence are in this game.
Welcome to the Powers That Be Daily, Puck's podcast focused on the intersection of Wall Street, Washington, Silicon Valley, and Hollywood, and the players who run it all. I'm Peter Hamby. It's Thursday, March 30th. Today, Tara Palmieri joins me from the Sunshine State of Florida with all the latest on the 2024 Republican presidential primary. Trump, DeSantis, Pompeo, Haley, and maybe Glenn Youngkin? Tara has the latest on who's up, who's down, and who might not actually run after all. And later, Julia Alexander and Ben Landy trade notes on how Netflix turned a Mel Gibson dud into a streaming blockbuster. We'll discuss all that and more on today's episode of The Powers That Be.
Knowing how to speak and understand a new language can be an invaluable tool when traveling, meeting new friends, or just even to master a new skill. But it's not always simple when you're bogged down by textbooks and structure classes. That's why so many people trust Rosetta Stone. Rosetta Stone is the most trusted language learning program, available on desktop or as an app. It truly immerses you in the language you want to learn, like Spanish, French, Italian, Chinese, and more. You won't just be studying English translations. The Rosetta Stone intuitive process helps you pick up a language naturally, first with words, then phrases, then sentences. Don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/rs10. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/rs10 today.
Happy Thursday, everybody. I'm joined today by Tara Palmieri to talk politics, specifically Republican presidential politics. Tara, you are in Florida right now on a reporting trip. Is that correct?
Correct.
You told me before we got on that you spent a little time earlier this week in Sarasota, which for people who don't know is like, and has been even before Trump, like a hotbed of just Republican grassroots energy. And you were talking to activists, et cetera, there. Just before we get into all the things we're going to talk about here, Donald Trump and the Manhattan DA, will Mike Pompeo run? Will Glenn Youngkin run? And, you know, what's up with Ron DeSantis right now? What is just like the zeitgeist in Sarasota, Florida? I mean, I love taking the temperature of these little pockets where you can really learn a lot about where Republican voters are at. Is it just Trump, 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 or are they hyped for DeSantis? What's the deal there?
I definitely sense that they are really excited about DeSantis. The people that I spoke to were very much DeSantis people, and they're privately torn because they're sort of having to choose between Trump and DeSantis because they're former Trump supporters as well. But I sense more enthusiasm around DeSantis, but they also acknowledge his shortcomings as well. And the idea that, you know, he's a very popular governor, but it's always different when you get up on the national stage. But I definitely sensed excitement for DeSantis there. But, you know, he's got this big bill coming up, the 6-week abortion ban legislation. And there's a lot of consternation about how this is going to play in the general election. And like, while it's a good wedge issue with Trump, it shows him being even more hardcore about an issue that like Trump has basically like brushed off, and it's annoyed evangelicals, which has like weirdly helped Mike Pence. So I see why DeSantis would be like, yeah, heartbeat bill, 6 weeks, yes. But in the general election, it could end up coming back to bite him. And a lot of donors are really worried about it because they don't want the Democrats to turn this into another Roe versus Wade election. And, you know, it really turns off swing voting, college educated women, and like his play to win the primary could end up hurting him in the general. And I think there's a lot of concern about how to deal with this because he's already publicly supported the 6-week ban. And I get it. Like, Ron DeSantis is looking for any wedge issue to be more hardcore than Trump, right? Even donors are like, oh God, please don't fall into this trap. You don't need it.
Well, I want to put a pin in the conversation around Tiny D, Meatball Ron, Ron DeSanctimonious, because Tina's going to be on the podcast tomorrow going deep on DeSantis as well. But I want to ask you about his chief rival at the moment, the front runner, Donald Trump. You and I were on the Brian Lehrer show in New York earlier this week. And so he obviously wanted to talk about the Manhattan DA. I let you handle that one since I'm just ensconced over here in Venice. Why has there not been any kind of indictment yet? Was Trump pretty smart politically to get out in front of this? Maybe Alvin Bragg's getting cold feet and he's realizing that there's some public blowback from Democrats about maybe doing this. This is ammo for Trump. And he might want to wait and see if the Georgia election interference investigation makes an indictment before he does in New York over Stormy Daniels.
I don't have any reporting to suggest that he is getting cold feet, but by all accounts, it looks like he's getting cold feet. but now I've seen reporting that they're talking about adjourning the jury for like weeks. Maybe that gives the Georgia prosecutor more time, because what I have heard from senior Democrats and what's very clear is that they're not saying anything publicly about it. They see no value in a six-year-old case about adultery, a bipartisan issue. The messaging really doesn't help them. It looks too political. And, you know, they don't think that Alvin Bragg is really the best messenger, since crime is really up in New York right now. And they're just sort of feeling like this is not our messaging vehicle. And that's how Democratic leadership thinks. And that's why you're not hearing about it from Chuck Schumer, Hakeem Jeffries, Pelosi, Biden, et cetera, because it's just not really their preferred method of talking about Trump. If anything, they wish that it was the Georgia case to be the first indictment, because it's about democracy and January 6th, and they'd rather talk about that. So very politically unpopular right now on both sides of the aisle. Now, I caveat that by saying any indictment against Trump is good for Democrats, because it turns off those same voters that we talked about, you know, swing voting, college educated women in the suburbs who are over the drama and don't want to vote for someone who's indicted. So it's ultimately good for Biden. But in the meantime, Democrats know the best thing is to not touch this one. Now, if you saw an indictment come down in Georgia, I bet you'd be hearing a chorus from Democrats saying, finally, justice is served, democracy, January 6th, election tampering. But this one, they're like, porn star, you know, six-year-old case that the DOJ passed on. Ugh, not really what we want to be using as our way to take out Trump.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, the Fulton County District Attorney, Fannie Willis in Georgia, you know, she's been looking into this since May of 2022, whether Trump tried to overturn the elections in Georgia, in part by calling Brad Raffensperger, the Secretary of State, and telling him to find votes. That seems like a more, man, I don't want to say more weighty issue, because, you know, if Trump broke the law in Manhattan, he broke the law in Manhattan. But anyway, I think I agree with Democrats on this one. Wait for something bigger. Hey, I want to ask you about, this is, I told you, rapid fire Republican politics. Mike Pompeo, he came out with a book. He got skinny Mike Pompeo. He's been talking about running for president. Yeah, I think you and I both agree. It doesn't seem like there's a real lane for him. Like, I don't know what his brand is at the moment. He was obviously a former CIA director before Secretary of State, member of Congress from Kansas before that. It sounds like you're hearing he's kind of given this whole presidential thing second thoughts.
Yeah, he's definitely on the fence right now. I heard that he's in Italy in his family's ancestral land, which is also apparently where Madonna's family is from. And he's really praying on it and contemplating. A few people close to me told me that he's inclined to not run. Another person called to say that actually he's still interviewing people in Iowa and New Hampshire as recent as this week. So he's still keeping his options open, but he's missed some really big opportunities to weigh in on the news of the day last week, because his lane really is kind of the same as Nikki Haley's lane. He's a hawk, worked in the Trump administration in a high profile national security role. And he was one of the first people to float the idea of banning TikTok. And it was his thing. And he did not even comment. He didn't even tweet about it. He has a Fox News contributorship. I'm pretty sure they can just call up and get on when they want and talk about these sort of things. His people can make sure he's a main voice weighing in on this. And, you know, he's the one who compared Xi to the Nazi regime over this. So it's like, where is he? Okay, he's praying in Italy. Fine. Eat, pray, love, Pompeo. But he's missing a lot of opportunities. And the wavering obviously has some donor types being wondering, is he really serious about this? But yeah, I think we're going to hear from him sooner than later, one way or another. But I think what is clear is there isn't really a clear lane for him as long as Nikki Haley and Mike Pence are in this game.
Yeah, and I think you're so right. Like, issues like TikTok and China, like, if you are running for president or, like, seriously considering it, in quotation marks, like, you would be on Fox talking about this right now. And the fact that he's not suggests something's giving him pause. The Haley thing is interesting, too. I mean, you obviously have Trump and DeSantis should be considered the front runners. Right now, it's hard to see anyone else becoming the nominee. But among the 1, 2, 3 percenters, Nikki Haley I hate to oversimplify things, but like she looks different from all the other white men on stage. She's a hard worker. Like she's just in that foreign policy lane. I mean, I don't want to split hairs with people in DC about how much actual foreign policy the UN ambassador does versus what Pompeo did. But yeah, I mean, she would be sort of trying to get in that foreign policy like hawk space with Nikki Haley. And I don't know which voter is going to choose Pompeo over Haley. Last thing, my home state, the Commonwealth of Virginia, Glenn Youngkin, he's been governor for a little over a year now. His quote unquote guru, Jeff Rowe, we love to talk about Jeff Rowe here at Puck.
This is the Jeff Rowe Network, JRN.
The Jeff Rowe Network, JRN. Shout out to Sasha Eisenberg for keeping tabs on us. Jeff, going back to Cruz 2016, has been like an in-demand strategist. He will apparently, I mean, you reported this, be working for Ron DeSantis' super PAC if DeSantis runs. That doesn't mean that Glenn Youngkin can't run for president. I think Glenn Youngkin's barriers to running for president are more that he's only been governor for like a year. And I don't know if he has that like killer instinct to go into a red meat Republican primary. But where's Youngkin's head out on this? Do you have any insight into that?
Yeah. So I spoke to someone close to Youngkin and I heard that, you know, he and Jeff Rowe have this sort of love-hate relationship. And Jeff was like, listen, you got to decide if you're going to run or not because I want to be on a presidential. And Youngkin couldn't give him the answer that he wanted. So he was blessed to go off to DeSantis land, which is really interesting because it's starting to look to me like a team of rivals since you had Phil Cox already in there and he's a pretty heavyweight consultant at the super PAC. Now you got Jeff Rowe. I don't know if Ron DeSantis knows that he's got, you know, some heavy hitters that usually are used to running their own shows. So we'll see how that one works out. Now, back to Glenn Youngkin land. What I have been told from people close to him is that he's really serious about making sure that the legislature flips in Virginia. He wants it to be red and he wants that to be his success story. And I think the elections are in the summer, I believe, or the fall in Virginia. So he's really focused on that. And he sees that as part of his legacy, something to talk about, if not in 2024, 2028, if he runs later on. So he's really focused on that. And he's got the advantage of being a really rich guy. And he's thinking like a Carlisle executive, which he is. And he's thinking, let me focus on this legislature. Let me actually have a story to tell of Virginia turning red. And then I can get in the race later on. I've got the money to build the ground game at the last minute. And I jump in there as a dark horse after DeSantis and Trump have been pounded away at each other. And I can come in there as a sense of normalcy and yada, yada, yada. And donors that are the type of people that he would need if he decides, you know, he doesn't want to self-fund because very rarely do these people want to use their own money. They, like I said before, they've sort of accepted that if they truly don't want Trump to be the nominee, they're probably going to have to back one or two candidates. So he's got that advantage. So I think it's an interesting game because it's sort of giving him optionality, not just for 2024, but for 2028. But he actually seems to want to talk about a Virginia success story. And I don't know. We'll see if that actually works out. So I think if Youngkin jumps in, it won't be until August after the first debate.
Interesting. Yeah. I mean, look, any candidate needs to run on their own merits and their own message and their own gut. And if they're totally dependent on like a consultant, you know, don't fucking run for president at all, because that's a dumb reason to run. And look, I mean, there are other people around Youngkin who helped him, too. It wasn't just Jeff Rowe. And I'm sure other people might want to line up for a new presidential candidate. You know what? You've been talking about this for a while, too. Like, and I want to give you some credit. The idea that there could be a backup plan if DeSantis fizzles, you know, the idea that there could be someone who gets in late. I mean, typically that never happens in a primary. Like you've got to get in early and build support, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But it certainly sounds like Youngkin is sort of eyeing this. Certainly, Christie is too, Chris Christie. But Youngkin feels like a little more in tune with the GOP heartbeat than Christie does. So we'll see what happens. Speaking of Virginia, just to wrap this up, speaking of Virginia's 9th Senate District and Senate elections in Virginia, my mom was a poll worker this week for the 9th District special in which Lamont Bagby won. This is all so inside baseball that no one listening cares, but hi, Mom. Good job doing your civic duty working at a polling location.
Thank you, Mrs. Hamby, for your service.
Have fun in Florida, and we'll see you soon.
Thanks so much, Peter.
When we come back, Julie Alexander is here to talk about, and this is a first, Mel Gibson.
You hear that? Your dog knows. Spring is coming sooner than you think. Dog walks, dog parks, playing fetch, all the stuff your dog loves to do with you. But the warmer weather also means that fleas and ticks are coming back. Fleas and ticks are in the grass, in the woods, and even on their dog friends. Fleas are an itchy nuisance, can easily get into your home, furniture, and beds, which can be terrible. Ticks are even worse. They're hard to spot, but can carry disease and get your dog really sick. PetMeds has your furry friend protected with the best products to prevent flea and ticks all year long. PetMeds pharmacists connect directly with your vet to save you time and deliver the best products for your pet. PetMeds offers low prices on all flea and tick meds, including NexGard, Simparica, and more. And PetMeds AutoShip helps you save even more with additional discounts on regular shipments of PetMeds, dog food, and other high-quality supplies. So get ready for all the spring fun now. Visit PetMeds.com and use promo code PODCAST to save 40% on your first auto ship order. That's PetMeds.com and promo code PODCAST.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm here with Julia Alexander. Hey there.
Hey, Ben. How are you?
I'm good. Julia, I wanted to talk about Netflix, and specifically, I wanted to talk about one movie in particular on Netflix right now called Dragged Across Concrete. First of all, have you seen this movie?
No. I keep getting told to watch it, though.
So I watched it, and it was good. It's borderline 3 hours long. It's a crime drama with Mel Gibson and Vince Vaughn. It's gory. It's a little bit funny. It's got a little bit of art house flavor, if you're into that kind of thing. But I clicked on it in part because I thought it was new. It was on the front page of Netflix under the new to Netflix category. It was trending. I just assumed it was original. And it's not. It's a 2018 movie that got decent reviews, actually pretty good reviews, but totally bombed at the box office. Basically, no one had heard of it. And this is not a novel observation, but it struck me that it's totally brilliant what Netflix does here. And I'm curious from your perspective as a insider in this industry, why is it that Netflix is so much better than other streamers at this very thing, at basically turning duds into blockbusters, because it feels like there's some sort of lesson there.
Yeah, I always think of it as Netflix's magical strength that has the ability to combine its scale with this kind of contextual algorithmic recommendations, that they are able to create what I refer to as kind of constantly rotating highs. So this is not something new in the industry. Actually, you see a lot of kind of blogs and Netflix-oriented Twitter accounts almost every month say, why is this movie trending number one? Or why is this TV show from like 20 years ago trending number one? Like, what is the thing that Netflix does? And what Netflix is able to do is combine having 230 million subscribers. So therefore, they can make something feel fresh, even if it's not, because to 230 million subscribers, it kind of feels fresh. And they can combine that with a couple of careful acts. So they put a red sticker on the title that says new, because it's new to Netflix. And if people aren't aware of what this movie is, I hadn't heard of it. I've been in this industry for close to a decade. I hadn't heard of it. It kind of feels like it's a new Netflix title. So automatically there is this, well, this is interesting. There's a new Mel Gibson, Vince Vaughn movie I've never heard of, but it's on Netflix. And so I think it's kind of new. What also they can do because of that scale and because of the ability to kind of lure people in with this really on-platform marketing, that's what it is at its core, is they can watch in kind of Los Gatos, where they're headquartered. They can kind of see how things are moving. And this is a great example of how Squid Game kind of worked, right? Squid Game can only work on Netflix because of its scale. The only reason that show worked is because it was on Netflix. If it was on Apple TV Plus, if it was on Peacock, it would not have gotten to where it was. So if you're in Netflix, you need that show to perform really well in South Korea. So you're watching it light up in South Korea. You're watching it do well. But then you're watching signals. You're watching people kind of organically find it in Japan, in Singapore. You're watching it move west as it starts to happen. So what you do is you start pushing it into the carousel, which for many years, many people in this industry have kind of referred to as the most vital piece of real estate in Hollywood. And so you push it into the carousel, and all of a sudden there's the show it says new on it. It shows that it's trending top 10. You kind of get a cool little sizzle reel that's all marketing. And all of a sudden you're creating newness. And whether it's a show like Squid Game or a movie like Dragged Across Concrete, because it's on Netflix, there is this feeling within this kind of very insulated ecosystem that this is new to me. And so they create these constantly rotating highs to make subscribers feel like they're getting additional value on 5, 6, 7-year-old movies, when actually it's just something that Netflix is able to get for a pretty cheap price. But because they have the ability to make it feel new, it ends up being a huge win in their favor that could not work for any other type of streaming distributor.
Yeah, Squid Game is such a perfect example of that. You really see there how Netflix has this sort of compounding effect where things that are trending, they achieve critical mass in the culture in a way that does not really happen on other streamers. And then it snowballs, and then it's in the media, and then everyone's talking about it, and it's on Netflix. It becomes a sort of perpetual motion machine where everyone's talking about it, and then you need to see it. And suddenly, to your point, a show that may have gone totally unnoticed if it had been on Paramount Plus or on Peacock is the number one most talked about show in the world.
The reason that Netflix needs these kind of constantly rotating highs is they don't have the type of owned content on their operated platforms to just rest their laurels on to an extent. If you talk to anybody at HBO, right? Like, obviously, they're very happy. A show like Succession brings in 2.3 million viewers kind of in its first night across all platforms. Something like The Last of Us, you know, is averaging 40 million viewers. Like, all of that is really great. But HBO is still a relatively niche product. So where HBO Max really rests on is its kind of Friends, right? Which they own. It's on The Big Bang Theory, which they own. And so it's on that platform. And so when people are asking, you know, what's the most watched shows on HBO, HBO Max, routinely month after month, it's like The Big Bang Theory. So because HBO Max has that, they don't necessarily need these constantly rotating highs. Now, that is not to say that they do not promote new stuff, but they're bringing in their own kind of content, right? There's a new Warner Brothers movie. There's like a new DC movie. There's all this stuff that feels very, very integral to the platform itself that is kind of owned. Netflix doesn't have that. If you think about the way that Netflix operates, they drop everything as a binge release. So they only have you for the weekend on that. And they have to kind of do this every single week. If they wanted to have a Wednesday every week, which is what they say they want to do, that would be extremely expensive.
The show Wednesday.
Yes, yeah.
We do have a Wednesday every week.
we literally have a Wednesday every week. But if they wanted a show like Wednesday every week, which is what Ted Sarandos, their co-CEO, said, that gets really expensive. So what do you do if you're Netflix? You know that you have the ability to kind of say, well, we can make old feel new, and we're going to spend less on this, and we're going to have more opportunity to have these because all of the other competitors are now saying, well, we need to license out our older content. It's not doing much for us. We don't need it. And it's not going to perform well for us on these platforms. On Netflix, it can. And the analogy I really want to use, because I feel like this will upset people at Netflix, if you think about how Blockbuster used to operate, right? You'd go into Blockbuster and here's all the new stuff. So you kind of go in and you're like, great, this is what's new. And then you'd have to go to the back and there's some older titles that you're going to sift through on a Friday night and you're like, maybe I'm going to finally tune into this. What Netflix does really well is brings those old titles out, slap a new sticker on it, put it in with the new titles, and all of a sudden you're going in and you're like, wow, this Mel Gibson movie I've never heard of because it didn't do well at the box office suddenly seems like it's a new release. So I'm really excited. I'm going to dig into it. And I think of it as a Netflix title. If you actually look at Google search trends for Dragged Across Concrete, like one of the highest level related queries is like Netflix original Dragged Across Concrete. That people are kind of like, this is a Netflix movie. That is something only Netflix can do right now because of its scale.
Yeah, and to take that metaphor even a little bit further, and I don't want to strain it because obviously there are differences between Blockbuster and Netflix. Netflix, like Blockbuster, is sort of a repository. It's a vault of a huge amount of content. And Netflix, also unlike its competitors, is not in theaters. I mean, with very few exceptions, it's not in movie theaters. It doesn't seem to have interest in the box office. Talk to me a little bit about that divergence in strategy, because there was also news this week that Apple and Amazon are going to be making bigger and bigger pushes into theaters this year. They're debuting a lot of original movies at your local AMC or whatever. That's an area where the Netflix strategy really diverges.
The best way to think about theatricality from kind of streaming first companies, right? And there aren't many of them. There's like Apple, Amazon, Netflix, right? Like those are kind of the big ones. Disney, Universal, Paramount, they're theater first in many ways. They have been. They kind of took a step back during the pandemic and experimented. And all that experiment proved was that actually the old way was working kind of well for them. And so they're going back to it. If you think about why these companies like Apple, Amazon, and Netflix would release a movie theatrically, it accomplishes one or two things. Ideally, both things. It either markets the streaming platform. So if you're an Apple, for example, you partner with a Paramount or Universal or whoever it might be, a Sony, they take the film out to theaters. They are the ones who distribute it. They're the ones who put the marketing into it. And then what that movie does is as it's in theaters, when it comes to Apple TV Plus, now there's this opportunity and heightened awareness to bring people to Apple TV Plus. That is one argument. And so it's really a marketing idea. The second thing, and this is where it gets into the Netflix aspect of it, when movie studios bring films to theaters, the vast majority of them do not make their core of their revenue or the core of their profit in theaters. If you think about how the theatrical breakdown works, you're giving 50 to 65% of all that revenue to theaters. So to the exhibitors, AMC, Regal, they're taking that 70%. Then you have the back end deals with talent. So the better that it does in theaters, which is great, the more that you're paying out to talent. By the time that you get down to what you're taking from theaters, unless you're a big Marvel movie, it's not necessarily a huge amount of money. You might break even, you might lose money. Where all these movies make profit is in what we refer to as the pay one, pay two window. So if you think about the journey of a film, it goes to theaters, let's say for 45 days, then it's available to rent or purchase on digital and Blu-ray. And then let's think about like a Disney movie. You might see that movie on HBO for 6 months, and then it's on something like FX or TBS for like 9 months after that. The first one, the HBO, is pay one. The second one is the pay two. The way those deals are made is like, if movie X makes this amount of money in theaters, then HBO will pay this amount of money because that is kind of what the deal comes in at. So the more that a film makes in theaters, the more that they're going to get paid on the first window and second window. But they're going to receive revenue for that title regardless of it. So if you think about Sony, Sony kind of strikes this $1 billion pay one deal with Netflix, right? So a movie like Uncharted goes to theaters, does $460 million globally, if I remember correctly. And then it's going to go to Netflix. It's going to perform well there. And Netflix is going to pay on behalf of those films that are coming in. It might be a little bit more than a billion, depending on box office or whatever it might be. That is core to the film distribution strategy. Now, if you're Netflix, you bring a movie to theaters, it maybe breaks even. Let's say it breaks even. You're not bringing it to a pay one, pay two window. You're not licensing it out to a Disney Plus or a fast service or whatever you're doing. You're just bringing it to Netflix. And the argument from Netflix's side is, we don't need to market Netflix. Netflix is used by 230 million people. There is some data that shows that having a film in theater, it makes it stronger for streaming platforms. But again, if you're Netflix, this whole conversation that we've had, what you're saying is, we can have movies on our platform that basically do pretty well. We can take older movies and we can make them feel like new movies, so that really satiates our consumers. And we don't have to worry about investing in huge theatrical teams at our company, dealing with the exhibitors, going out and potentially losing money. And at the end of the day, the caliber of Netflix film is not up to par with what might draw people out to theaters for 3-4 weeks. So take that all into consideration. You can see why Netflix would want to be in theaters. Will they forever not be in theaters? I think that if Apple and Amazon does pretty well, it gives Netflix the ability to kind of change their strategy. But as of right now, there's no real reason for them in their minds to go to theaters.
And so it sort of seems like we're evolving towards a point where Netflix is going to become even more distinct in their unique strategy because they have that scale that very few other people have, where everyone else is sort of moving a little bit in the opposite direction.
Yeah, and I think you hit the nail on the head, right? It is, as long as Netflix has the scale that no one else has, Netflix has the advantage of being able to say, well, we can kind of control perception of what is new and what is valuable and what commands attention. That's very much a Netflix strategy. It's very much a Netflix strength right now. That will change. Their competition is coming up. Companies like Amazon and Apple are spending a lot of money. Disney Plus is quickly growing, and they've got great catalog. Where Netflix is going to have the core advantage over the next couple of years is that all these other companies are looking to kind of pay down these principal debt payments that they have to pay down. Where they kind of look is, okay, well, this movie isn't doing much for us. We're going to license it out. You actually kind of saw this with Arrested Development, which was supposed to leave Netflix and is now staying on Netflix. And, you know, I tweeted out what really works for Netflix is because they know that Disney just needs the money from it and the general entertainment isn't doing much on Hulu. Netflix can negotiate that price out and say, well, it does decently for us, so we'll keep it, but we're not going to pay what we were going to pay for it. If you attach that kind of negotiation strategy to all of these films that are 20, 30 years old, that all these platforms are not necessarily seeing the efficiency on it that they really need to, Netflix can say, well, we'll take it off your hand, but we're going to take it off for, you know, 50% less than what we were originally going to pay for it. And because Netflix has the scale to make that feel new, if people are tuning into it, if it's a dragged across concrete or whatever it is, if people are tuning into it, both on the ad level and on the subscriber level, then you get from an ad level, increased engagement, so that's increased profit in your pocket, or revenue, I should say. And on the sub level, it really creates that idea of perceived value because there's a constantly rotating high, so everything feels fresh, and so they can see reduced churn and increased acquisition.
Yeah, for all the fear mongering about Netflix, it does seem like they're definitely in a unique position. Julia, I always love talking about this stuff with you. This is so much fun. Thanks as always.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks so much for listening to another episode of The Powers That Be. As a reminder, The Powers That Be is the official podcast of Puck. We'd like to thank Ben Landy, Liz Goff, and Alex Bigler for their editorial and production guidance. If you like what you hear, please share with a friend. It really helps us keep delivering the inside scoop that only Puck can offer. Follow us on Twitter at Puck News. I'm Peter Hamby. See you tomorrow. This has been a presentation of Cadence 13 Studios. Please listen, rate, review, and follow all episodes wherever you get your podcasts. The Powers That Be Daily is executive produced by John Kelly, co-founder of Puck, Chris Corcoran, chief content officer and founding partner of Cadence 13, and produced by Ben Landy, executive editor at Puck.